Now, I'm not going to do this every evening, but I just want to give a recap of what we were doing last week, and particularly with regard to the structure and the title on the card, as I explained to you and as you will have noted, no doubt noticed, is the Christian worldview credible? And I went through different aspects of that question, answering it last week and explaining why we were really thinking about this. And I explained the approach that we were taking. And that approach, I put a big label on it, but really it's quite a simple explanation. We're taking a presuppositional approach. That is, we are assuming that the Bible is correct, that actually it is true, and that it is God's words to us. It is God's explanation of reality to us, how things are and how things should be. And I said that we were presupposing that these things were true, and therefore we were asking the question, is it credible? Does it answer the big questions that we're faced with in the world around us? For example, last week we were thinking about the question that where did I come from and why am I here? Two questions really, forming the big question, why is there something rather than nothing? And we were thinking about the idea that, we were thinking about origin, and we were thinking about purpose. And we saw that with regard to our origin, we came from God. God made the worlds, we saw in Acts chapter 17. We exist because of him, but we are also here for God. Therefore, because we are here for God, we should seek him, as we're instructed to do in Acts chapter 17. One of the reasons I love that passage so much is that it actually could be spoken in this day and age. A lot of the Bible is like this, but this specifically. It could be spoken in this day and age. It could form an address in this day and age and be entirely relevant, even down to the point that the philosophers are the same and the objections to the gospel are the same, and the defense that Paul gives of the gospel is a defense that is entirely relevant to the world in which we live today. People often say that the Bible is not relevant. Well, that story shows that the Bible is relevant, for it answers these four questions that we have before us over these 4 weeks. We were thinking really that these four questions are the four questions that must be answered by a worldview. Christianity is a worldview. Actually, I said last week that really there are only two worldviews. There is the Christian worldview and there is every other worldview. In fact, I quoted from a book called The Other Worldview. And really, the whole point in that book was to say this, and the point of my quote was to remind us that either we accept the Creator is the cause of all things, or we accept that the creation is the cause of all things. And it doesn't matter what religion you're looking at or what philosophy you're looking at, it all really boils down to that great issue. Do you accept the Creator, or do you accept that we came from ourselves? Human beings are a self-generating and self-continuing species. Well, this evening we turn to our next question, and the question is, what went wrong with the world? And in addressing this question, we're not now thinking about origin or purpose, but we're thinking about the question of morality. We are here and we know we're here. Our senses tell us that we're here. It is through our senses that we experience the reality that is around us. And the question really is then, how then should I behave? What should I do? And when we think about this whole question of behavior and morality, we would have to take a good look outwards at the world that is around us. Mind you, we'll be taking a good look inwards as well. But we would have to take a good look outwards and say that quite clearly there is something wrong with the world. That there is something wrong with this world, I think we can all agree. We might not agree on what it is. We might not agree necessarily what its nature is. But I am sure that we would all agree that there is something wrong with the world. I mentioned last week about doing these meetings in a town not so far from here. And before the meeting, an elderly man came up to me, or an older gentleman, shall I say. I don't think he'd like the description elderly. And he came up to me and he said, you could answer tonight's meeting, before this meeting it was, because you could answer tonight's meeting with one word. I thought he was going to go for the obvious one, which we will get to later, but he said to me, the one word you could answer this with is everything. What is wrong with the world? Everything. Maybe you're not quite of that mentality. Actually, what was interesting was after the meeting, I was speaking to some younger people, and they came up to me and said, well, we wouldn't agree that everything is wrong with the world, but some things are wrong with the world. That really kind of explains the divide between the young and the old. The young have lived through it. They've been through it. And they've seen the same things repeated over and over again. Sorry, the older have been through it. They see these things repeated. And so a little bit of skepticism and cynicism sometimes sets in. And so when they're faced with a question like this, they will answer everything. Well, the young, a little bit naive. In fact, the two young men that I spoke to were not Christians, and they didn't, well, we agree that some things are wrong, but not everything. Maybe even if you are young and optimistic, you would agree with me on this point that there is something wrong with the world. And really the question that we need to answer, rather than what went wrong with the world, is always the harder question to answer. Maybe we'll start off with the question, what is wrong with the world? When I speak to people that aren't Christians, what went wrong with the world immediately is a pejorative question, because they know you're looking back to a moment in time when something wrong entered into time. And they don't like to address that question, so they'll answer this question, and this is where we'll start. What is wrong with the world? What is the nature of this wrong? Now, we can all see it around us. Some people, for example, they get terribly upset about terrorism. Terrorism is a blight on humanity. Some people get very upset, and rightly so, about racism. Racism also is a blight on humanity. Some people get upset about paedophilia. It is a blight on humanity. Bigotry, pride, these are all symptoms of a problem that is in the world around us. Mind you, they're not the problem itself, but they are symptoms of a problem that is in the world around us. And you look at all of that today and you say, well, that's all out there in the world. Maybe I haven't really experienced it myself, all of those things. Maybe you have. But maybe I haven't really experienced those heinous crimes myself. But really, I would just look at all of that and I would say it's in the world. And I know that it is the cause of a thing that we label as human beings called suffering. When we would put it all under that title and we would say there is suffering in the world today. I'm sure we would all agree with that. And maybe you say, well, that is the cause of all of the problems in the world. That is what went wrong with the world. That is what is wrong with the world. It's the problem of suffering. Well, is that the problem, or is that one of the symptoms of the problem? What is the underlying cause of that problem? Well, maybe you say, well, actually, okay, I take your point. That's not, they are symptoms. I agree with that. We were all taught well in our school days to do root cause analysis, just as you were. So we'll keep asking the question why until we can't go back any further. I agree with you that. Well, I suggest to you that the problem is a social justice problem. That there is great inequality in the world. Sometimes you see it manifested as gender inequality, and sometimes you see it manifested as racial inequality, or whatever it might be. There's all of these injustices in the world, and actually what we need are more interventions and more causes and more campaigns and more programs and all of the rest of it, and more Facebook activism and more social media activism. And if we can just get more of that, then eventually our problems will evaporate and they will disappear. We live at an age, because of social media and because of the age of technology that we're in, when there are more social justice interventions than ever before. But the question that I ask you is, do the problems go away or do they persist? Actually, do they get worse? It seems to me, at least, that these problems don't go away. They do persist, and worse than persisting, they get worse. We experience them to a greater degree. Maybe you don't look at it as a social justice issue, or not specifically, and you say, well, it's a political issue. You know, the problem with this country is that there are too many conservatives, and the conservatives want to maintain the status quo and preserve what is there. And really, if we could just progress, if we could just get rid of all of the shackles of our upbringings and all the shackles of our traditions and all the Victoria ages that still rest with us, if we could just get rid of all of that and go to a new progressive kind of politics and launch straight into it and bring in all of these wonderful things that progressive politics brings. Much of it is a lot of social justice, by the way. But anyway, if we could just do that, then we would be able to throw off the shackles and we will be able to deal with the problem. Well, let me tell you something. We have been attempting politics since man existed, in either official forms or unofficial forms. And I repeat the point that I made for social justice intervention. Our problems get worse. They don't get better. They get deeper and they get more contrived. Maybe you think it's neither of those. You think it's an economic issue. By the way, all three of these are very closely interrelated. But sometimes you hear people and they just focus on one. And Occupy Wall Street, for example, just focused on the one issue. It's an economic problem. This is what Karl Marx thought. If we could just sort out the economic inequality in the world, we can resolve all of the world's problems. Well, governments of various colours and stripes and badges have tried opposing policies on economic issues for a long, long time. I'm not going to say as long as man has existed, because economics as a discipline hasn't existed for that long, but they've been trying it for a long, long time. And actually, the problem has not gone away. It is still with us. And it is as deep. Back in 2008, we had a major economic shift. We came away from what is called tax and spend economics to monetary economics. And we stopped spending, 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 and we went austerity, austerity, austerity. I ask you the question, I'm not passing any comment on whether that's the right thing or not. I ask you the question, have our problems gone away? Do we live in a world that is utopian, that where we now we are liberated and we are enjoying ourselves and we don't have any worries, financial or otherwise? We don't. I think that is evident. Social justice, politics and economics do not come anywhere close to identifying the real problem. And that is why they would fail. Actually, you would sooner clear up our River Thames with a mop and bucket than you would solve the world's problems with social justice or politics and economics. So the problem is not what is the most commonly suggested solution. All of those are actually solutions to the problem. But does the fact that there is a problem, we agree there is a problem, does it matter? After all, humanity has continued for millennia despite these problems. Does it really matter? Do we need to worry about these? Well, I would suggest that the fact that we make expensive and detailed plans, sometimes at great personal cost, proves that most people think that the world's problems do matter. Actually, to the Christian, the reason we preach the gospel is because we think that the problem in this world matters. In fact, we think it matters more than anything else in this world. Hence the reason why we convene meetings like this and we come to preach the gospel. But even those of us that aren't Christians, we would agree that problems in the world do matter and we make great efforts in order to make sure that they are addressed and that there are solutions to them. Often we fail. Now, before answering the question that is on the flyer, which is what is wrong with the world, I will do that, but I'm going to leave that to the end. I want to first answer two other questions that are very closely related. Actually, the question that's on the flyer is one way of presenting this problem. There are two other ways that you will most commonly hear it presented. One, for example, is a very personal way of answering it, of asking it, and that is you'll hear people sometimes say, why do bad things happen to good people? The question that they're really getting at, or the issue that they're getting at, is that there's a lot of inequality and unfairness in the world. Bad things do happen to good people. Really, the title, the word that you could write over that is suffering. People suffer. There is suffering in this world. We were thinking this morning that suffering sometimes is the cause of our own actions, sometimes it is the cause of other people's actions, and quite often it's just the cause of nature, it's just the cause of events. There are a whole lot of people today who in Haiti are suffering for no cause of their own, and it's not my cause, and it's not your cause. In fact, it's nobody's cause other than the fact that a hurricane has blown across their country. Now, the question that people are forced to ask, or do ask in this question, is why do bad things happen to good people? Another question we ask, and we're going to address this one as well, is if there is a God, and we prove, well, we proved to my satisfaction at least, that there is a God last week, and we'll do so again this evening. If there is a God, then the question is, why does he allow suffering? Now, I want to address those two questions, and then we'll come to the final question, which is going to be, so what went wrong with the world? And actually, what we'll find is that really we should address that question first. Now, I'm not going to do that for a reason. If we did address that question first, we would have the answer straight away to the questions that we're going to look at. But I want to use those questions to bring out some interesting points around this whole subject of morality. The first question that I want to think about will help us understand why we care so much that there is a problem, and that question is stated as, why do bad things happen to good people? We care because we view ourselves as intrinsically good. We do. Humanity does that. There are very few people that I've met that think of themselves as bad and will openly tell you that. Maybe there are certain institutions at some not too far from here, and you could go and speak to some people, and they would willingly tell you, I'm a bad person. But actually, 99.9% of the population view themselves as being intrinsically good, and therefore undeserving of bad things happening to them. It's a very interesting question, and the reason I find this question is so interesting is because the very question itself presupposes the existence of an objective standard, or an absolute standard, of good and bad. Or, if you prefer, of right and wrong. But the question I say to you this evening is, who says that these are bad things? You say, well, hang on a minute, I'm talking about things that are obviously bad. I'm talking about genocide in Rwanda. Or I'm talking about terrorism in Brussels. Or if I could use a local issue, and I do so carefully, I don't want to make a debating point out of someone's misfortune, but you say, I'm talking about rape in Oxford. These are obviously bad things. How can you even question the point that they are bad? Well, the question I want to ask you is, why are they bad? Why are they bad? And while we're asking the question, why are they bad things, let's ask another question. And who says we are good people? So if we have a question before us, which is, why do bad things happen to good things? There are two further questions that I want to ask. Number one, why are these things bad? And number two, why are we good? The problem that an atheist has when they're asking this question is that actually they are asserting in their own question that there is such a thing as an objective standard of absolute moral goodness and badness, or rightness and wrong. They are talking about a sense of morality. Now, it is my contention from the verses that I quoted to you last week from Romans chapter 1 that every single one of us has a sense of morality, and the reason we have a sense of morality is because God has implanted it into us. He has put it, if I might use these modern expressions, he has put it in our DNA. Actually, it's not in our DNA. It's given to us by God. He has put it in us. He has given it to us. So that's what I would suggest. But the question that I ask somebody who doesn't believe in God and who would challenge me this evening with the question, why do good things happen to bad people? I'm saying this to you. Number one, who says they're bad? And number two, who says we are good? Now, most people here this evening, I am sure, would agree that there is such a thing as an objective standard of right and wrong, or of good and bad. We agree that that is the case. And even atheists that I have spoken to, or agnostics or other philosophers, they say, yes, it does exist. So the next question that I want to ask is, where does this standard come from? You say, well, that's obvious. It came from my parents. Well, I see the point that parents play an important part in reinforcing that and making sure that is ingrained into people's minds. But an interesting thing about parents disagree sometimes. There were plenty of houses that I was not allowed to go to when I was being brought up, for the simple reason that my parents did not agree with the standards that were upheld in, or the lack of standards that were, in their opinion, that were upheld in that house. Actually, interestingly, this is being recorded, so I should be careful, but I see it in my own family. The standards that my mother has are different to the standards that my sister now has. There is a difference even within a family, even by somebody who was brought up by her mother, there is a difference between them. And I see it not only in my own family, I see it in other families as well, where mothers disagree with daughters about how they should raise their families. Well, obviously parents cannot be the final standard of right and wrong. If I wasn't allowed to go to people's houses because they didn't agree with the standards, and if there are different standards of parenting in the society in which we live. You say, well, hang on a minute. Society upholds the standard. Well, we have debates all the time within society about what kind of society is the right society. You just have to turn on a television, if you have one, at 10:30 on a Thursday evening, I think it is. And David actually banned me from watching it. But anyway, there's a program called Question Time. If you prefer the radio version, it's on a Friday evening, and it's called Question Time. It's called Any Questions on a Friday. One thing I'll tell you about this is that there is little agreement as to answering these great questions in the society in which we live. And in fact, when we talk about the society, what we're really talking about is the prevalent or the prevailing culture that is around us. Culture changes all the time. What is culturally correct today was not culturally correct 5 years ago. In fact, I have seen, even in my short lifetime, things that 20 years ago were absolutely wrong by the standard in the culture are now absolutely right in the standard of the culture. So culture cannot be our guiding light of objective standards of right and wrong. You say, it's the government. The government has a statute book. That statute book is full of laws. Those laws are the upholder of what is right and wrong. They are the determinant of what is right and wrong. Well, first of all, I'd ask you the question, who passed those laws? They were passed by people. People that are not a lot different. In fact, many of them are probably a lot worse in the way they live their lives than you or I. Second to that, governments disagree. You only have to travel 300 miles to here before you'll be in another country. And they have a different statute book to what we have. In fact, it's so different that if you want to be a solicitor in this country, you have to retrain to be a solicitor in that country. You cannot just pass between England and Scotland and practice law as if nothing has happened. Why? Because there is a difference in the statute book. The differences are so big that you have to be retrained. And we have a debate every 5 years. And in that debate, where we all go, if we want to, and we put a little X in a box, we can't even agree between ourselves what the best form of government or the best kind of government is. You say, well, okay, I take it parents, no society, no government, no. Myself, this is the most common one these days, I'm the standard of what is right and wrong. Well, here's the thing. What happens when what I want contradicts what you want? When something that I think is right is not what you think is right. And so you want to do something, and you need my agreement to it, and I say, no, thank you, I don't want to do that. Who's right and who's wrong? Who gets their way? Do you just do it by who the minority are? Sometimes we have little discussions about what should happen and what shan't happen. Families have them, and churches have them, and different people have them, and we have a discussion. How do we come to that agreement? Well, very often, I'll speak about families rather than churches, the minority gets to say. The minority, the person that doesn't want to do it, gets to decide. And what happens when that cuts across not just one person's view, but 5, 6, 10 people's view? Who's right and who's wrong? This reminds me of a story that Ravi Zacharias, who's a Christian apologist, he told while he was answering a student at Nottingham University many years ago. This student had objected that the existence of evil disproved God. So Mr. Zacharias, he pointed him to a discussion between a philosopher called Frederick Copleston and the atheist, famous atheist who's now dead. His name is Bertrand Russell. He said, Mr. Russell, you do believe in good and bad, don't you? And Bertrand Russell answered, yes, I do. He says, well, how do you differentiate between them? Well, the same way I differentiate between yellow and blue. But Mr. Russell, you differentiate between yellow and blue by seeing, don't you? How do you differentiate between good and bad? Rather scoffingly, he said, well, on the basis of feeling, of course. What else? Rabbi Zacharias, at that point, interjects into the dialogue. He says, Mr. Copleston was a kindlier gentleman than many others. He says, for the appropriate logical kill at that moment would have been, Mr. Russell, in some cultures they love their neighbours, in others they eat them, both on the basis of feeling. Do you particularly have any preference? That's a humorous way of underlining this point, that we cannot be the final guide of what is right and wrong. I cannot decide what is right. There might be subjective issues where I have to make a determination on things, but I am always doing that by appealing to a higher standard. That standard for me is the Bible. And actually, when you actually come down to it and think about it, most people have a higher standard. The question is, what is that higher standard? We encountered this last week with these Epicureans and these Stoics. And the Epicureans did what felt right, what was pleasurable. They used that as their guiding light. And as they were thinking about the decisions that they made in life, I was talking about Epicurus and his garden, where he invited people along. He had some kind of garden community going on where all sorts of debauchery was taking place. What was right, what was good, was what felt right, what felt good, what was pleasurable. Whereas on the other hand, the Stoics, they were doing, well, it was all duty-based. It was still what felt right, but it was duty-based. What they determined was their duty. There are many ways in which we can think about this in our society, but the ultimate description of this is, or the ultimate example of this is murder. When somebody takes another's life, they have denied them of all of their rights against their will. And you say, well, I'm the determinant of what's right. Well, that works fine, maybe, circumstantially, until you're faced with a serial killer. And that serial killer decides that his way in life is to take your life. Who's right, him or you? And if you take the standard, or if you take the view that actually you are the determinant of what is right and wrong, then you have no complaint with a serial killer who is in front of you wanting to do what serial killers do. There's a man called Jerry Coyne, who is an evolutionary biologist and an atheist. He wrote a book called Why Evolution is True. And he claims this: there can be no such thing as objective or absolute moral values. By the way, this is just an aside, but a good opportunity to poke a bit of fun. For someone who refuses to accept that there are absolutes, that sounds like a remarkably absolute statement. There are no objective moral values. Well, if there are no objective moral values, you have absolutely right to say there are no objective moral values. But anyway, Richard Dawkins, who always gets mentioned in meetings like this, lives down the road there in Oxford, also an evolutionary biologist and atheist, he agrees. He says this: there is no evil and no good, nothing but blind, pitiful indifference. The question I would love to ask Mr. Dawkins is, why did he feel it was necessary last week to tweet in response to an American voter stating that Trump is my guy because he tells it how it is? This is what Dawkins responded with. No, he doesn't. He tells it like it isn't. He lies and lies and lies and lies and lies. Well, who cares about lies if there's nothing but blind, pitiless indifference? Mr. Dawkins does not sound very indifferent to me. Those of you who know anything about Mr. Dawkins, of course, and his work will know that he is anything but indifferent. He rather sounds like a man described in Romans 1 who is deliberately drowning the truth, deliberately holding it under. So, if humans are just accidents of nature, as Jerry Coyne says, and Richard Dawkins say, highly developed animals, but animals all the same, then why do we care so much when humans behave like animals? And why do we, by far and away the vast majority of us at least, restrict our own freedom out of respect to others? What is it that drives us to do that? Last week, a cat killed a mouse that it had hunted in the field next to our house and left it on the path. It didn't even have the manners to finish its meal, let alone arrange a funeral. The question I ask is, why don't you do that to me? And why don't I do that to you? The point is this, is that we have within us an inbuilt moral law. Why are we outraged when people do it to each other? Here's the conclusion. Premise number one, if God does not exist, objective moral values and duties do not exist. But we know that objective moral values do exist because we live by them every day. They are the principles that tell us that stashing loads of cash in a tax haven is wrong, or killing each other is wrong, or even killing the cat that killed the mouse is wrong. The conclusion, therefore, is this, that God exists. This argument is the most difficult. We were talking about some of the arguments last week, evidential arguments and logical, classical logical arguments. I said I didn't want to go into too much detail because we were taking a presuppositional approach. By the way, this is by far and away the most difficult argument for an atheist to refute. There is no such thing as morality if there is no God. And yet they, all of them, to a man, very few of them don't, all of them to a man, live their lives as if there is a God. Yet they spend their energy, their ink, and their breath trying to prove that they're not. They can be honest, like Mr. Dawkins and Mr. Coyne, but inconsistent, and say that actually we are just animals. But the fact of the matter is, we all care. Mr. Dawkins, as I was looking at his Twitter feed, I was surprised that he very much cares who the next president of the United States will be. If there is blind, pitiless indifference, who cares? I mean, I actually don't care, but that's for different reasons. But anyway, Mr. Dawkins does care and is spending a lot of time actually at this moment touring America, speaking to students, asking them to vote for Mrs. Clinton. It sounds to me like a man who does not practice what he preaches. The fact of the matter is, coming back now to some of the questions in front of us, is that we suffer. All of us suffer, and nothing that an atheist can say to us can change any of that. We all experience suffering. Whatever the identity of the world's problem is, and we'll come to it, we know it personally in our subjective experience when we come across it. Sometimes it is seen in illness, sometimes it is seen in crime, whatever it might be. We know what it is to suffer, every one of us. One of the core foundational experiences of the human experience is suffering. But the point is this, if there is no God, then there is no such thing as suffering. Suffering does not exist. Suffering only exists because there is a God who can allow it. If there is no God, it's not suffering. It's just nature. It's just atoms banging into each other. It's just me behaving according to my pre-programmed way of behaving. It's just tidal waves. It's just all of this. It's nothing. It's blind, pitiless indifference. Therefore, why complain about suffering? When I'm wiped out, if I'm wiped out, I hope I'm not, but if I was by a terrorist in somewhere during my travels, I cannot complain if there is nothing. I have nothing to say. My family can't complain. They have no issue because there is nothing. There was no meaning to my life anyway. I was here as a pointless exercise in nothing, and therefore, why complain? But every one of us has an inbuilt decision or an inbuilt trigger that causes us to experience suffering and to complain. Moral suffering caused by moral evil. Natural suffering caused by natural experiences and circumstances. But if we suffer, and we do, and God exists, and he does, then the better question to ask is, why does God allow suffering. This is the issue that tends to bother non-Christians most. They think it's the final nail in the coffin to Christianity. And if they can get a Christian to answer this, or get a Christian onto this subject, then they've got them in a headlock, and the Christian will never be able to get out of this headlock. It's the issue that bothers them most. In fact, in a poll that was conducted recently, it was found that far outstripping any of the questions that we dealt with last week, or any of the questions that we'll deal with in the remaining 2 weeks, this was the most popular question. If God exists, why does he allow suffering? Now, I admit that there are problems with this question. And there are problems that the Christian needs to face. But those problems do not, by any stretch, disprove God. In fact, actually, the fact that there is a problem proves that God exists in the first place. Well, you might turn around and say, well, actually, obviously, the fact that there is suffering is evidence that there is no God. This was the position of a man famous, known to most, I would imagine, called Charles Darwin. I read a brief autobiography of his recently, and what struck me about it was his real journey to atheism. You might think, he got on HMS Beagle, he travelled down to the Galapagos Islands in the 1820s, and he saw wonderful things of science and biology. And as he saw these wonderful things that were happening all around him, it caused him to jot down his ideas, synthesize it into some kind of working thesis, come back, explain it to a few people, they all agreed with him, he put it into a book, and that book was written and it was published, called On the Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection, or The Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. You didn't know that was the full title, did you? But anyway, you knew it was called The Origin of the Species, at least. And he said that was the course that Mr. Dawkins took. That's the course Mr. Dawkins wishes he took. That's the course that Mr. Darwin took. No, not at all. In the 1820s, he did get on the HMS Beagle. He did go down to the Galapagos Islands, and he did observe what he thought were strange things in nature. But actually, it was not until the death of his eldest daughter, Annie, at 10 years of age, in 1851, almost 40 years later, that he described as a bitter and cruel loss, that he finally buried his hesitant religious faith in the coffin of his dead child. Actually, it was his experience, it was his tragedy, his personal tragedy, that drove him into his atheism rather than his supposed scientific discovery. That is very interesting to me for two reasons. Firstly, personal tragedy drives people one of two ways. I know people who have experienced personal tragedy as Christians, and it has forced them onto the mercy of their God. But equally, in the experience of Mr. Darwin, it forced him away from God. He rebelled against God. No doubt he blamed God for his situation. Prior to that, his father had died, which had put him into a deep depression. His wife, actually, who was a committed Christian, she saw him taking this pathway away from religion. She used to write out Bible verses for him and give them to him. She was very worried about the faith, supposed faith, of her husband. So the marks had been there, and it started with the death of his father, and it culminated in the death of his youngest daughter. Personal tragedy drives people one of two ways: to God in the experience of many, and away from God in the experience of others, including Charles Darwin. But the other reason I find it interesting is that personal tragedy is a subjective experience and cannot ever be used to confirm or disprove God's existence. This was an argument that an atheistic philosopher called J.L. Mackey articulated. And it's very common, you'll hear it sometimes said, if a good and powerful God exists, he would not allow pointless evil, because there is much unjustifiable, pointless evil in the world. The traditional God and powerful God, good and powerful God, could not exist. Some other God or no God may exist, but not the traditional God. Let me summarize that for you. He's taken a lot of words there to explain something that can be summarized like this. The God of the Bible cannot exist because he claims to be good and powerful, and therefore he cannot allow suffering. There is a major flaw with that argument. And the major flaw is this, that just because we cannot see or imagine a good reason why God might allow something to happen, it does not mean that there cannot be one. You say, explain that a little bit more. Well, let me use a Bible example. In the Old Testament, one of my favorite stories is of a man called Joseph. Joseph was the son of Jacob. And he was his favorite son, rightly or wrongly, but he was the favored son. So much so that his father bought him a coat of many colors and treated him as if he was the king of the castle, if I might use that expression. That's not a phrase you'll find in the Bible, but let just allow me my interpretation of the situation. In fact, his brothers came to hate him because of his favoritism that was shown towards him. So they conspired against him to slay him. They couldn't even speak peaceably to him. They conspired against him and they wanted to kill him. So one day Joseph leaves the home of his father with some messages for him, taking some provisions, and he went off to find his sons. They saw him coming and they thought, this is our chance to get rid of this boy. He's a pain. Let's do something to get rid of him. So they had a bit of a discussion between them as to what they could do. And eventually they took him and they decided that they put him into a pit and then they sold him to some traders. Joseph's brothers were the first recorded slave traders in the history of our world. His life it spiraled out of control. He ended up down in Egypt. He ended up down in prison. It took a bit of a good turn for a while. Somebody alleged some immorality against him and he ended up in prison. There in the midst of the prison, you might have thought that Joseph's life was just a life of suffering and a life of impossible shame. But God intervened. In the midst of all of that suffering, and there was lots of it, and lots that we would never probably even have to go through in life, God intervened. This was the summary that Joseph gave of his life. Eventually, there was a famine in the land where his brothers were. They were forced to come down to the country of Egypt where he was. He is now the Chancellor of the Exchequer of the country of Egypt. He's the second in command. And there he is. He's been commanded by the Pharaoh to get control of all of the substance of the land and to distribute it to the people that need it. And these boys now, they come down from Canaan. They're men now. They come down and who do they end up before? Joseph. Eventually he reveals himself to them. These are the words that he uses. You thought evil against me, but God meant it for good. To bring to pass this day to save much people alive. So the fact of the matter is there is one Bible example at least of why out of what must be pointless suffering, God can work good and he can use it for his glory. There are many people in the meeting this evening that subjectively, in their own experience, have seen this very fact, that something bad has happened and maybe even at that moment in time they thought it was the end of the world. I've been there. And yet God works those circumstances to bring out of it something that is good. I know people that even came to become Christians because something bad happened that they thought they'd never even get to the end of. And yet God used it to bring them to himself. And through it, he demonstrated his mercy in the person of Jesus Christ. We all can talk about examples of that. I spoke to a man recently who had had cancer and he told me that cancer had changed him. And as I was speaking to him, it became clear this, that what he meant was cancer had changed his personality. It had knocked edges off. He says, I'm a far more compassionate man now. I see people that are suffering and I have compassion and empathy. I'm a far more tolerant man. I'm a far less angry man. And he talked to me about a number of things that God had worked out of this sickness and out of this suffering in order that he might bring about something that was good. So God is not the author of evil or of suffering, but he can use it. It was C.S. Lewis who was talking about this subject of evil. Can't believe it's taken me almost two sessions to get to C.S. Lewis, but a local apologist, one very famous, and he was speaking about this whole issue of pain and suffering. It was ironic. There are two books that he addresses it. The first is called The Problem of Pain, and the second is called A Grief Observed. And this was a book that he wrote upon the passing away of his wife. And he was so engulfed in his grief that he wrote it under a pseudonym. And one day a friend came to see him. He said, I've got a book for you that will really help you. And put a copy of his own book on his desk. I thought that was quite ironic. But anyway, C.S. Lewis, he wrote about this. He says, evil has no essence of its own, but it is the corruption of what is good. It is the privation of what is good. He said, well, where did it come from? Is God the author of evil? No, this is what we need to understand. Actually, God created us as free moral agents, every one of us. He gave us a free will. You say, why did he do that? Because he is interested in having a people for himself that will worship him out of their own volition, that will be totally and utterly dedicated to him and devoted to him out of their own desire and of their own will and volition. God is not interested in making us into robots and conscripting us as if we were convicts, to acknowledge him. God never forces his will on anyone. In that regard, he is the ultimate gentleman. But in creating us as free moral agents, there is inbuilt in us not only the capacity to make right moral judgments, as we all of us do on many occasions, but also to make wrong moral judgments. And that is the corruption of ourselves. That is evil within ourselves. We make wrong moral judgments and we do bad things. This is the quote that C.S. Lewis had in his book on it. He said, God created things which had free will. This means that creatures which can go wrong or right. Some people think they can imagine a creature which was free but had no possibility of going wrong. But I can't. If a thing is free to be good, it is also free to be bad. And free will is what has made evil possible. Why then did God give them free will? Because free will, although it makes evil possible, is also the only thing that makes possible any love or goodness or joy worth having. So the question we come back after answering all of that is, what went wrong with the world? In the words of C.S. Lewis, evil, or in the words of the Bible, sin. Sin is using our God-given free will to violate God's will. Therefore, in the words of our passage that we've read this evening, sin is idolatry. It started in the Garden of Eden in Genesis chapter 3, where Eve was presented with something that was her will rather than God's will. The devil came along in the form of a serpent, and he challenged the word of God. When he challenged the word of God, Eve doubted it, and she sinned. She gave to her husband also Adam. Adam, knowing better than Eve, he deliberately partook, and the Bible says, as by that one man, Adam, sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And so death has passed upon all men. Why? Because all of us sinned in Adam. What the Bible is telling us, and this is something that we must get right when we're answering this question. This is the root of all problems. This is not the symptom we're now dealing with. This is the root cause. When Adam sinned, he lowered the whole of society, humanity. He took everything that was. He was there at the head of the family tree. Every one of us has descended from Adam. No wonder evolutionists are so determined to remove Adam from their thinking. They will do anything to remove a real Adam. Why? If they can get rid of an Adam, they get rid of the whole gospel. If they can get rid of a man who originally sinned, they can just eradicate the whole of the gospel. But no, God says this, there was one man, Adam. He was given God's will, he was given God's command, and he deliberately went against it. And so by that one man's sin, sin entered into the world, and death came as a result of sin, because all of us have sinned. You know, the reason we make wrong moral choices, which the Bible calls sins, the reason we make those wrong moral choices is not because... Well, let me put that another way. We are not sinners because we make those wrong moral choices. We commit those sins because we are originally from conception sinners. From the very point there in my mother's womb, this is what David says, but it's true of me as well and it's true of you. From that very point in my mother's womb, I was conceived, I was a sinner. Fallen in Adam. And as Paul walked around in Athens, his spirit was stirred in him. His soul was moved in him when he saw the totality of the idolatry that he saw in Athens, to the point that he's disputed with the relativist philosophers of the day every day. Idolatry comes from making decisions that are best for me. And it was exactly that both the Epicureans and the Stoics were doing. They were only concerned with what interested them. Duty on the one hand, pleasure on the other hand. And as Paul looked at this city, he says, in every aspect of your life, you are too superstitious. They were covering all their bases. Could you imagine making an altar with an inscription on it to the unknown God? And yet that's what they were doing. And there are many people. I know a man today who is not convinced that God exists, but he goes to church every week because he's just not sure that he does. He will not risk it. He's superstitious. His conscience tells him that God exists, and his brain, which has been besmirched by the society of scientific thinking around it, is fallen. And so he's permanently conflicted. But yet he cannot drop going to church because he's just not sure what might happen. And he cannot drop his science because he's just not sure what will happen. He's too superstitious. And that is what Paul saw in the world around us. So having answered our main question with a very simple little word called sin, We can then really shed a little bit of light on what we've been thinking. Why does God allow suffering? The answer is, he doesn't. God does not allow suffering. Suffering is caused by sin, and sin is against God's will. He has laid down his moral code. He laid it down in the Old Testament in 10 commandments and more commandments around it. But that's not what we're really interested in this evening. The Bible tells us that he's written it in every one of us. We know what is right and wrong. We know instinctively what is right and wrong because God has built it into us. He doesn't allow suffering. Suffering is sin, and sin is against his will. You only need to read the New Testament to understand that God is a God who is not the author of suffering. Actually, what the Bible tells us is that to redeem us from the cause of our own suffering, which is sin, he entered the world himself as a man and suffered. Sometimes I get very frustrated with people. I used to debate a man all the time, and he would talk about suffering. Suffering was his key thing. And he would say, God cannot allow suffering. You know, if God will not allow suffering, then there's no redemption for any one of us. There's no salvation. Where was God, he asked me one day on September the 11th. Where was God on 2005, July the 7th, 2005? Where was God? And he went through all of these great events in history. He talked about Auschwitz, and he talked about the gulags in Russia, and he talked about North Korea, and all of these different places. He says, where is God in the midst of human suffering? Well, the God that I know in the midst of human suffering was literally in the midst of it. For Jesus Christ is a man, was a man who came unto this earth, but yet he is God himself. God took part in flesh and blood, so that he might go to the cross. For what reason? To die the just one, the only just man, the only right man, intrinsically right man that ever lived. He died on the cross. Why? To bring us for God. Says Paul to the Corinthians, Christ died for our sins according to the scriptures. I'm going to close with this. In Luke 13, some men came to the Lord Jesus by one day, and they asked him the question, why do bad things happen to good people? You won't find that in Luke 13, but that's a summary of the issue that they brought before him. They brought before him a tower that had fallen. And really what they were talking about was natural evil. Events that happen in the world that are out there and that affect us all from time to time. And then they talked about a moral evil. They talked about a mini genocide where some people who had been sacrificing at the altar had been slain by the political authorities of the day. And so they talked about these two things, a moral evil and a natural evil, a genocide and a tower that fell. Well, that is the wrong question. There are no inherently good people because sin means we are all bad. And the Lord Jesus showed this up when answering them with their question. He said this, except you repent, you shall all likewise perish. You know, when answering a question like this, it's very easy to think about the world and the problems in the world and all the rest of it. And we could miss the real point. And the real point is not what is wrong with the world, it's what's wrong with my heart. Every one of us. The sum total of the world's problems do not make us bad. But it's our individual hearts, the problems of our individual hearts that make the sum total of the world's problems. And each one of us has rebelled against God. Individually, purposefully, of our own volition, of our own desire, for nothing else other than we are idolaters. We worship ourselves and our sin. And in doing that, we have rebelled against God. And in doing that, we lower the whole of the totality of humanity. Yet, we have heard this evening of the fact that God has made a plan to redeem us from that and to bring us back to himself. It's that plan that we're going to really think of in lots of detail next week. The question will be, is there any hope? And I hope that you can return next week. Thank you for listening this evening. Remember this, what went wrong with the world? Sin. But yet God has made a way for us to be saved from our sins through salvation in Jesus Christ. Shall we pray?